Welcome underground. We have a guest. Artem is back, phoning in from his European headquarters. He made us read Martin Heidegger's The Age of the World Picture, a 1938 account of the nature and pitfalls of modernity that has relevance to themes we talk about a lot on this show. Perception, ancient Greece, even AI. I'd like to attribute my personal lack of value add to the substantial calorie deficit my trainer has me on at the moment. But the truth is, I understood about one word in three of the essay initially. After an hour of Artem's tutelage, however, everything became clear. Come with me on the same journey and enjoy.
Yeah, so maybe it's worth just reflecting on the basics of Heidegger, just in case. I'm sure there aren't, but just in case there's anybody out there, or in case there was anybody on this podcast, in fact.
Can you imagine?
Who wasn't 100% familiar with the life and works of Heidegger. So perhaps, Artem, I can lay out what I think I know about Heidegger and you can correct me. Would that be enjoyable?
Sure.
I'd enjoy it.
So he comes from the phenomenological school of Husserl, and the phenomenologists are people who say, well, we need to stop concentrating on the external world, and in fact, we need to call into question somewhat that categorization of external world, and instead we need to focus on what is in fact manifest to us, which is phenomena. So other philosophers might call it qualia, that which appears to us through our senses or within our sensorium. So instead focusing on the perceiver and the perceived as opposed to the external, that's the kind of phenomenology kind of element of it, I guess. Artem's making not wholly encouraging head movements, listeners, so I'm faltering a little bit.
I'm seeing stifled laughter. But.
Then Heidegger goes one step further than that. He says, well, actually, instead of just focusing on the apparatus, as it were, because the phenomenologists, right, then instead of focusing on the external object, you know, the tree, you focus on instead the thing, the apparatus that's viewing the tree, i.e., you know, you, as your first port of call. But then what Heidegger says is that basically this entire scheme in which you are conceptually separate from the tree, you are the subject and the tree is the object, that is the root of our misconceptions. And in fact, we need to think of these things as a unity. And that's what he calls the Dasein, which is the being in the world, you know, the viewer in the world, the viewer and the viewed being the world. They are a unity. And that's kind of my headline understanding of Heidegger. So perhaps you could, you know, pick that apart to our educative benefit.
Yeah, I think that's pretty popular conception of phenomenology that you outlined. You definitely will meet it in lots of places. You know, I already hinted my view that kind of textbook introductions to these thinkers, they are kind of an affair doomed to fail, and almost they do more harm than good, even if you can do your best to try to introduce them in the best way. Because Heidegger especially, he's very much working on the at the end of a very established tradition, and a lot of his work refers to that tradition, it challenges it, redefines it. And, you know, I would not recommend Heidegger as an author to start your foray into philosophy to anybody, not even as your second or third author. Maybe you can actually get quite far in philosophy before you really start making sense of why what Heidegger is doing has any kind of value to it. Why are these problems so pressing? It's not at all obvious. It's kind of, you know, it's the 20th century after all. It's like if you pick up a mathematics treatise from 20th century, you'll probably be at a loss of what exactly these people are doing and why. You know, you will be told, for example, that every field is a ring, and that will be confusing because that seems to make no sense. But and it just takes a lot of work to try to understand what the text is doing. With phenomenology, so there is that focus on the acts of consciousness. But another famous slogan of Husserl that you also see everywhere is actually back to the things themselves. So at some point you said a very nice thing, which is it's this dyadic formulation. And it is precisely looking at the subject as the field in which objects open up, and it's looking at objects as something that opens up to a subject. Looking at that relationship as inherently correlative. So a more kind of naive understanding that we might have of the subject and the external world is that, you know, there is an external world somewhere out there, independent of consciousness. It just exists, and a subject arrives in it and receives like signals, waves, whatever, activation of stimuli, activation of his senses by stimuli, and builds up a kind of a picture, representation of the world. That's kind of the common scientific, you could say, way of understanding the relationship between the subject and the world. Phenomenology kind of wants you to problematize both the idea of the independent external world, but also the idea of a subject as something independent of the external world, and rather see the two features as mutually constitutive. And basically these two words, like correlativity and mutual constitution, they are very important to phenomenologists, even to the early ones, even to Husserl. And really the top line, what the phenomenologists are interested in, are what they call intentionality. And that's the idea that consciousness is always about something. And that means there is something for it to be about, which is going to be the world. But also this world only opens up in the acts of consciousness which are about it. And that intentionality, the relationship of aboutness between the subjective pole and the objective pole, and the fact that these two are precisely poles of a single relationship, is kind of what phenomenology is all about. And, you know, it comes in the 20th century. It comes after lots of discussions around this topic. So it is not easy to get your head around of how did we even get here, right? If you read a bit of Hume, you read a bit of Kant, it then becomes more comprehensible why these people are doing what they do. Heidegger's innovation in phenomenology, it's always an interesting one of how much it is an innovation. He himself positions himself in contrast to his teacher, Husserl, and says that he is doing something completely radical, and that Husserl was completely misguided, and that he had this little idea about this being in a world. He was too focused on consciousness, on transcendental structures, which we're not going to touch on what that even means. But him, Heidegger, he is very practical. He is all about embodiment, being in the world, as a situative presence. It's actually very questionable to what extent, this is more of a caricature of Husserl that Heidegger uses to position his project than a fair account of Husserl. But still, Heidegger, yeah, for sure, he works out practical themes in phenomenology, the situatedness in the world. He comes up with the idea of Dasein, which is kind of his term for the subject. But actually, in this article, image of the world picture, you will see Dasein doesn't really come up all that much. And a lot of the heavy lifting that Heidegger does in his philosophical work, it's not all that present here, right? There isn't all that much phenomenology, like the world phenomena is sometimes mentioned, but we don't really see this subjective viewpoint all that much. We don't see a discussion of intentionality. He just talks about something that I think many of us can understand, which is like just, what is it that defines specifically modern thinking? How does that thinking differ from the thinking of the medievals or the Greeks? What are kind of the institutional features of modern science? And how it all relates to basically our view of being and beings, which is just a view of what is out there in the world and how do we interact with it. And I kind of like the article because it's fairly independent of other work that he might be doing.
Okay. I had a layman's understanding, perhaps not a refined understanding, which is better, as a better outcome. Oh, no, maybe not. Go on.
It's not even a layman's understanding. That's underselling it, I would say. There are plenty of professional philosophers even that have a cursory familiarity with phenomenology, and they would tell something similar. They will say, well, phenomenology, especially Husserlian phenomenology, is all about introspection. It's about attending to the quale, as you would say. That, for some reason, is a very widespread view of what phenomenology is. It is definitely not about that, at least not in such a naive way. It's precisely about things as they are given. It's not about attending to very subjective experiences, and the way phenomenology proceeds in its kind of studies, it's kind of a very systematic way of describing precisely how things are given, like a very famous phenomenological theme. Just to give one example, is how do we get a spatial conception of things, right? So how do we see things in perspective and as many-sided? So, you know, I'm looking at my computer, for example, at the moment. From a qualia point of view, you could say what I see is the screen. But in my seeing of the computer, I don't just see the screen. I see the screen precisely just as one side of the computer, and I know full well that there is another side to it. And, for example, all my seeing is actually sided in this way. I always know that I'm looking from a point of view, and I always know that there is something hidden from me. So whatever I see, I don't just see as revealed. I also see as hiding the other side. You know, when I look about on a at an object placed on a table, the object might be square. It's lying on a table. What I see from my perspective is not square at all, but I generally see precisely a square object. I don't see the shape distorted by perspective, which I then somehow unpack consciously to reconstruct the square in my mind. No, the squareness of the object is already given in my seeing, and phenomenologists kind of try to understand, well, what is the structure of experience that enables this kind of presentation? What constitutes squareness? And that's kind of a very far call from what you might yet by hearing about this attention to sensory and quale and all that. It's actually about the structures of experience which are interpersonal, and that's why we're able to describe them and talk about them, right? The like specific things that I'm seeing and the, my private experiences, I can't really say much about, and they're not all that interesting philosophically. Like, there is this topic of nobody really knows what is it that you and I see when we see a color? Like, red might look to you the way blue looks to me, and we would never know.
Yeah, we even feel like something. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's not what phenomenologists are discussing. Actually, the interesting thing is that it completely doesn't matter whether or not a color looks the same way to you and me, because that stays private. But even if that side is completely different, we're still able to work with each other and understand color, even if our experiences are completely different. Well, how is that possible? That means there must be some structure to color, which is precisely interpersonal and independent of the purely subjective sides of it. And all the phenomenology is like that, but people don't tend to know it. Not a layman's understanding at all. Yeah.
If I were to kind of boil down into the simplest terms, then what I think I've understood from what you're saying is that phenomenologists want us to stop thinking of the senses as these passive receivers of the external world, and they instead want us to start thinking about the senses as things that go into and open up the world in a particular way that enables us to live as the kind of beings that we do. So it's more of a kind of a two-way, or even maybe perhaps a one-way relationship, rather than the senses acting as passive receivers. Instead, they are more like radar. They're going out into the world and they're constructing phenomena with prior structures implicit within them. Have I understood that right? I mean, the key idea being that they're not passive, they're active. That's the intentionality bit, right?
Oh, that's definitely a great part of it. And in a sense, actually, phenomenologists kind of foreshadowed a lot of the advances that empirical psychologists have only achieved recently, because, you know, it's only been in the recent like 20 or 30 years that empirical psychologists discovered that senses are not actually passive, that what goes on in our perception is there's a lot of prediction going on. Our biological apparatus constantly forms predictions, and it really uses the senses to kind of correct these predictions on the fly. And phenomenologists would have told you that literally 100 years ago, because if you really think about it philosophically, it absolutely has to work this way for a whole number of reasons.
Well, it's another example of somebody figuring something out just by thinking about it properly. I mean, my favorite example of that is Lucretius in De Rerum Natura. Sorry to wind this back 2,000 years, but when he basically says
Heideck's not afraid of that.
Yeah, when he basically says that, well, that most objects must be mostly empty space, because how else could sound travel through them? And when you think about it, A, that's an obvious thing, and B, it's exactly right, sort of scientifically, because you have to have the space for the atoms to move and knock into each other for sound to travel. So he's dead on. But of course, we didn't get the empirical sort of verification for a good couple of thousand years.
Yep.
And that seems to be a similar instance, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's kind of like that.
So that's phenomenology then. So the idea that we're not passive receivers. This is how I'm summarizing it. I know it's more subtle. We're not passive receivers, but we are active participants in opening up the world with our senses. So Heidegger then, the way that I was kind of, another way that I sort of conceptualized this was the idea of thinking about, you know, the cover of The Dark Side of the Moon album by Pink Floyd, you know,
the prism.
The light in the prism, and then the you know, the light splits the other side of the prism. Uh-huh. It seems to me that kind of classic empiricism is concerned with what's on the white light side of the prism. It's concerned with what is out there before it hits our senses. The prism is, you can think of as like our senses, are literally, you know, our physical senses, so the fingers and eyes and, you know, tongue and whatever. And then the colours out the other side, well, that's qualia, right? And it seemed to me that classical empiricism is concerned, as I said, with the white light and what's on that side of the prism. And then the phenomenologists, I'd previously thought maybe were more slightly interested in the qualia, but now I know that it's more subtle than that. But it seems to me that Heidegger wants to say that, no, it's totally wrong to split this up into three in any way. You know, this is actually all just a unified phenomenon called being in the world. Is that a very, very kind of simplified, rough way to put it? Or do we just, am I wrong and we just need to scrap that?
Well, I think that's right. It's more right even for Husserl. And so the unity, the mutual constitutivity, the correlativity, the inability to separate the subject from the world or the world from the subject is central to the phenomenological project overall. So a lot of the presuppositions that an empiricism takes for granted are exactly what is problematized in phenomenology. And problematized doesn't mean kind of seriously doubted or put up to be criticized and kind of rejected. Rather, the whole idea of phenomenology is we try to understand the grounds upon which we can come to the scientific conclusions that we do. You know, so we operate in day-to-day understanding with a picture of there being this external world, which produces some kind of signals, which falls upon our senses, which in turn might produce something in our consciousness. The whole idea of phenomenology is to question, well, how exactly we got to that point and how can we really believe in it properly? You know, what are the grounds for that? What Heidegger also wants to bring is, which is quite novel from Husserl, and that comes out in this article quite a lot, which is the modern way of thinking about the world is only one way of thinking about the world, not necessarily the best one, actually one which has certain dangers to it, and something that needs to be kind of overcome if humans are going to move towards being their more authentic selves. And that's a kind of whole question of, well, exactly what is problematic with it. But so Heidegger's idea...
As soon as philosophers start talking about being their authentic selves, I don't know, it makes me sort of start to be a bit twitchy.
Yeah.
you know what I mean?
By Heidegger's time, that was fairly new. Before him, there was probably only Nietzsche, which Heidegger references quite a lot.
Nietzsche is the one I immediately think about, because, of course, Nietzsche and Heidegger famously... Well, you know, Heidegger famously was a member of the Nazi party, and Nietzsche famously sort of prefigured... He wasn't a Nazi himself, of course, but he was drawn upon by some Nazi thinkers, and he also died sort of as a trembling madman, as far as I understand it. So I suppose that when this is what we were talking about, actually, what I was talking about when I was texting you the other day, Artem, when I was saying that it seems to me that this idea that you can become your authentic self, that you can somehow sort of slough off the conceptual framework of modernity, which is kind of what you've been talking about there, the idea that actually the way that we see the world in modernity is a conceptual framework and it's not the only one available. It seems to me that both Heidegger and Nietzsche kind of get excited by this idea and they're like, well, if we can transcend the conceptual framework, then we can choose our own conceptual framework, and then we're not bound by, you know, conventional morality or anything like that. We can, like Superman, you know, choose our own conceptual framework and therefore our own morality. And, you know, isn't that going to be wonderful? Then we can be our authentic selves. And my sense is that that doesn't really lead to a very good place. And I would argue that empirically it didn't for either of them. But maybe I'm just leaping too far ahead there.
I think that's very good. I think this actually gets us to some of the real meat of this article, the age of the world picture, because Heidegger is very clear on
40-minute intro there. Done. Yeah. Let's get to the article. Yeah.
he's very clear on both points here. So, for example, firstly, is this idea of a modern worldview and it being not the only worldview available. So Heidegger's point here is that actually this idea of worldviews is itself a very modern thing. So it's a very modern thing to look upon the position that you occupy as a view, whilst concurrently being aware that it is only just a view and that is not the only view available, and that the Greeks also had a view and medievals had a view and so on. Because, of course, neither the Greeks nor the medievals would look at it this way at all, right? This whole idea of worldviews, of being able to look at the world from different points and pick a conceptual picture which suits you, that is the essence of modernity.
Yeah, I can happen within this view. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's one thing. And the other thing is about the superseding. So actually, you know, Heidegger is very careful here. So there are also the appendices to the article. So in the first appendix, he says that, you know, the questioning that belongs to reflection, however, does not fall into that which is groundless and beyond questioning, because in advance it asks after being. That remains that which is the most worthy of question. And then he says that reflection on the essence of modernity places thought and decision within the sphere of effectiveness belonging to the authentically essential forces of the age. These forces work, as they work, beyond the reach of everyday evaluation. And then he says that it is a matter of, in advance and continually, grasping the essence of the age from out of the truth of being that prevails in it, for only thus is that which is most worthy of questioning simultaneously experienced, that which bears and constrains a creating into the future which takes us beyond what is at hand and lets the transformation of humanity become one that springs from the necessity of being itself. No age lets itself be undone away by negating decree. Negation merely throws the negator off the track. So this is exactly what you've been talking about. We cannot wish ourselves out of the conditions we are in. We are not free to dismiss the picture that we inhabit, because we're constantly kind of experiencing the work of the essential kind of tropes or modes of thought that prevail in the age that we live in. What we can do at most is understand this age, and by understanding, try to then transform it into something else. And again, it's the entire age that needs to be transformed. It's not up to a single person. I really like this phrase of, you know, no age lets itself be undone, lets itself be done away with by negating decree. Negation merely throws the negator off the track. So he is exactly agreeing with you. He says that what you said we cannot do, or we shouldn't hope to do, is exactly what we cannot do.
Mm. Okay. Well, he seems a little bit wiser than I gave him credit for then. That's good. It's good to know. So he's basically saying then that we have these assumptions. We come to the world with these assumptions. These assumptions are the grounding of the age that we're in. So the grounding is sort of everything. It's our metaphysical assumptions. It's our manners of thought and all of that kind of thing. It's there. It's the substrate, right? And you can't step out of it, but you can change it. You can't deny it, but you can sort of nudge it in a different direction if you are a true philosophical Superman. Have I got that right? Or not as an individual, perhaps, but as a collective act of reflection.
Yeah, his point is a little bit more interesting. So what you have outlined is, you know, probably what Kant would have said, right? And actually kind of what he did. He said that there are these a priori structures of consciousness, the transcendental categories which structure all our experience, and all we can do is kind of apply them. And he even considered these to be kind of timeless for all humanity. Heidegger is actually saying something else. So he is saying that in modernity, and you know, we look at science as an example to see kind of modernity manifesting in its essence. What does science do? Something like physics. It puts forward a rigorous research program. The rigor of the research program consists precisely in putting out of question the basic ground plan. And he gives the example of physics. He lays it out that, you know, we look at space, we look at bodies moving in space, we consider these as being driven by forces, and that kind of gives us the conceptual architecture through which everything else will then be seen in physics. And in modernity, we know that physics is not the only science, right? There are a whole bunch of sciences. There are a whole bunch of different ground plans. So it's not like modernity is a single ground plan. That's actually exactly what modernity is not. Modernity is that peculiar condition in which we study everything in view of a pre-established ground plan, but we understand that these ground plans are numerous. We kind of even see this attitude itself as being a kind of ground plan. We can then look upon the Greeks or the medievals as inhabiting a completely different conception. But this way, we also kind of, for the first time, put forward what could be a Greek ground plan of reality or a medieval ground plan of reality. In some sense, modernity does not have one, exactly because it allows for continuous shifting of view. Which brings kind of Heidegger to the other idea, which is what's so weird about modernity, is that once you have adopted this multiplicity of potential ground plans, it's hard to say what is really worth doing or fighting for, or, you know, being itself kind of got lost in it, because now what you have is this repertoire or inventory of ground plans from which you can choose. The subjects are portrayed as these active beings that go around choosing whichever ground plan is most fitting for matter, some matter at hand. It's not clear what the criteria for this choice are. Basically, that's kind of that's what the modern condition is. And the way out of this condition, to Heidegger, is also kind of all the ways out are internal to the age itself, right? As he's already said, it's not like dreaming of something beyond ourselves, because it's not really something that we can do. But Heidegger's ultimate point, that's the final section of this article where he talks about the gigantic and the incalculable. So his idea is that, you know, on one hand, we describe this very nice picture, right? That we have these a priori ground plans, like the physical one or the biological one, which establish a classification of beings under some kind of conceptual scheme and promise a way to understand everything that there can be through some appropriate ground plan. That in itself kind of sets a limit to the age, because what is the limit of the age seen from this perspective? Heidegger's idea is that, let me just go back to it, he comes up with this idea of the gigantic, which I thought was quite funny. Let me just find it.
That through which the quantitative acquires its own kind of quality.
Yes.
That's quoting Stalin, isn't it?
Well, at some point, quantity becomes its own quality.
Yeah. Quantity has a quality all of its own.
Yeah.
That actually goes back to Hegel, and Stalin said it because of Marx. So there's a nice little bit of classical German philosophy warming its way into the Soviet thinking there.
Nice.
Okay. So yeah, he says, the fundamental event of modernity is the conquest of the world as picture. From now on, the world picture means the collective image of representing production, and that's just kind of building up projections of reality on the basis of ground plans. This position secures, organizes, and articulates itself as worldview. The decisive unfolding of the modern relationship to beings becomes a confrontation of worldviews. And this is something that we've just covered. For the sake of this battle of worldviews, and according to its meaning, humanity sets in motion with respect to everything the unlimited process of calculation, planning, and breeding. Science as research is the indispensable form taken by the self-establishment of the world. It is one of the pathways along which, with a speed unrecognized by those who are involved, modernity races towards the fulfillment of its essence. And this is where the gigantic comes up. Like, a sign of this event is the appearance everywhere and in the most varied forms and disguises of the gigantic. At the same time, the huge announces itself in the direction of the ever smaller. We have only to think of the numbers of atomic physics. The gigantic presses forward in a form which seems to make it disappear, in destruction of great distances by the airplane, in the representations of foreign and remote worlds in their everydayness produced at will by the flick of a switch, so talking about television and radio and so on. One thinks too superficially, however, if one takes the gigantic to be merely and endlessly extended emptiness of the purely quantitative. One thinks too briefly if one finds the gigantic in a form of the continual never ever having been here before to spring merely from a blind impulse to exaggerate and to excel. One thinks not at all if one takes oneself to have explained this appearance of the gigantic with the slogan Americanism. So, what he starts with is that, you know, modernity, as we described, becomes obsessed with large scales, large buildings, skyscrapers, just showing the accomplishment of the conquest of the world by producing things that before could not even be imagined. But the real point is that this, in the next paragraph, is that as soon, however, as the gigantic, in planning, calculating, establishing, and securing, changes from the quantitative and becomes its own special quality, then the gigantic and the seemingly completely calculable become, through this shift, incalculable. This incalculability becomes the invisible shadow cast over all things when man has become the subjectum and the world has become picture. And the idea here is that in the drive to show the mastery of the world, humanity is driven to produce things which are precisely kind of beyond its mastery. It's basically this endless self-overcoming and the obsession with things that cannot be comprehended. And it's precisely these things which cannot be comprehended that form the kind of internal limit of modernity, because modernity itself becomes obsessed with this limit in an attempt to ever supersede it, as it were. That's kind of, we don't know where that will go, but according to Heidegger, that's the idea of what can drive to a transformation to something else. I think he wants to hint that the incalculable eventually has to be found not in the material world, but in something that cannot be grasped by this method of research, of establishing ground plans and building up projections of reality on the basis of them. And that would kind of bring us back to matters of spirit. And that's why it ends with a poem. So that's kind of my idea of how Heidegger sees modernity can shift on its own terms, as it were, into something beyond itself.
It's so interesting. I've name-checked this guy a couple of times, but Roberto Calasso, in his book, The Ruin of Cash, he identifies the spirit of modernity as the continual drive to cross the boundary. So it's the continual urge to cross the next boundary and the next boundary and the next boundary. And he kind of links this to the redundancy of sacrifice, the fact that we've got away with sacrifice, because sacrifice kind of polices the boundary between the known and the unknown for him. It just was really making me think of that. The other thing that I was thinking of when you were explaining all of that, Artem, which I also thought about a little bit when I was reading the article, which is that I think Heidegger would point at AI and be like, I told you. Because AI seems to me to be the absolute epitome of what he's talking about as the spirit of modernity, in the sense that it is pure calculation. We don't really understand how it works. And it doesn't, as far as we can tell, have being beyond calculation, right? So he kind of, he seems to me to identify calculation as a kind of one of these key features of modernity, because it goes into, is part of that laying out of a ground plan that you then calculate. You calculate from things in advance. X should end up at point Y, given the application of this force. So it's calculated in advance. And he seems to me to be talking quite a lot about this idea that calculation replaces understanding, or it replaces sort of being in the world. And that's one of the features of modernity. And then thinking that AI, you know, is the epitome of that. Is that a kind of a valid hot take, or is that just a kind of a confused ramble?
Yeah, absolutely spot on. And a lot of reawakening of interest in Heidegger is exactly because of these things. So something else that's a topic both of the article and Heidegger in generally is machine technology and the replacement by machine technology of authentic human beings. So that's absolutely one of his favorite topics, and he has a lot of interesting thoughts on like how we no longer have real things. Instead of what we have is an inventory of machines, which are kind of not grounded in any kind of context. They're fully replaceable, fully disposable.
Software subscriptions spring to mind. Yeah.
And it's one of the reliance on machines is one of the ways we cut our attachment to the world, exactly because you know, we're no longer contextualized in a world of things, but instead reliant on this shifting inventory of disposable and replaceable matters. And
They're substitutable, aren't they? They're substitutable. Mm, one is exactly the same as the other. You know, the value is the same. There is nothing about one thing that discriminates it from another. You can substitute them perfectly and you haven't lost anything. And the definition of a human being is that it is not substitutable because it has a unique being and consciousness. It has an ego and an I. And I think that idea of the tension between what can be substituted and what can't be is one of those kind of really, really deep ideas that's quite hard to articulate but runs through everything.
Yeah, you know, that's absolutely central to Heidegger. So a lot of his work is devoted precisely to this question.
Mm. Shout out to the Iliad. I think the Iliad is all about that, right? So the idea that, you know, when Agamemnon says he has to give up his slave girl because Apollo's angry at him. And he says, well, I'm going to take Achilles, I'm going to take your slave girl instead of Briseis. Achilles, you know, his refusal and his sulk and, you know, the entire driving of the plot is Achilles' refusal to be substituted for Agamemnon. And Agamemnon, as the king, tries to substitute someone else for him in his predicament. And Achilles says, no, I will not be substituted. And in a way, there's a way of looking at the plot of the Iliad where it's all about substitutions, both with, you know, Menelaus and Paris and Achilles and Agamemnon and Briseis and Chryseis and what can't be substituted. And that's the lives of the individual heroes, and that's Achilles' central point in the whole poem. He says once the spirit of man has left the guard of his teeth, nothing can bring it back. And that's the thing about being human, isn't it? You can't be substituted, but an AI, it can just be substituted. You know, it doesn't matter. You're a machine, you can just buy a new one. Breaks, buy a new one. It's fine.
Yeah, and you know, so Heidegger's favorite kind of genealogy of human thought, which is not really offered as a serious history, or people discuss that, but it's exactly what he says. He thinks that the really ancient Greeks, the pre-Socratics, had a lot of these very important insights that we lost because that philosophy got completely obscured by Plato and then the pupils of Plato. And so in this article, it comes up, he says that, you know, on the other hand, the fact that the beingness of beings is defined for Plato as eidos, appearance of you, this presupposition, which long prevailing only immediately in concealment and long in advance, predestined the world's having to become picture. And the world becoming picture is the essence of modernity. So for Heidegger, Plato is kind of one of the, well, you can't really say bad guys, but the Platonic idea is the original sin of the metaphysical point of view that then ends up finding its kind of full fruition in modernity. And of course, the gigantic comes up in the AI also very nicely, because it is in many ways the manifestation of gigantic, and just, you know, you throw as much data as possible at this thing. How does it work?
Yeah. Just as much commute as possible. Yeah,
just by processing
as much electricity as possible. Yeah.
and actually so much data that is literally infathomable to humans, and the processing itself becomes infathomable just due to sheer size, right? We kind of know exactly what the machine does because you can inspect the weights of the neural network, but it's just so big that you have no idea what it all means.
Oh, well, Heidegger's much sounder than I thought he was.
Yeah, is there also a sort of connection? We've talked on a couple of podcasts about the sort of differences between Western thought or Enlightenment thought with its desire to classify things and create these ground plans, and more Eastern thought, you know, Japanese, where it's a lot more about aesthetics, it's a lot more, you know, zen and balanced, and it thinks a bit more abstractly. And the lament from some Japanese thinkers that we got there first to a number of scientific advances, and so as a result all of science is based on this desire to classify and put things in boxes, but that actually we might have got as far as we can with that, and to make the next steps in you know, if you think of quantum physics or AI, you've kind of got to get away from classification and move on to something a bit more spiritual.
Got to get on something more relational, haven't you? The idea, yeah. This is like the idea of the relational interpretation of quantum physics, the idea that you stop thinking in terms of subject and object, viewer and viewed, and you start thinking in terms of, well, what's the relationship between properties? You kind of decentralize yourself as a subject, and suddenly it all starts to make a bit more sense according to the relational interpretation. And I think that people link that to the Eastern ideas of the dissolution of the ego or the abnegation of the self, and seeing things much more of as a sort of a unity, an interrelational unity, the entire world, and this is a way into at least believing that you can get more of a grasp on what's going on in quantum. That's what I've seen in the sort of the popular literature. I don't know, does that sound right?
Yeah, it's a connection that has been made many times. Husserl in particular. So as I said, this kind of correlativity is integral to all phenomenology. With Husserl, for some reason, there is this very popular movement of associating him with Yogacara, which is a specific Buddhist school. And apparently a lot of Husserl says kind of maps very well on some of their own things. And it's actually true that a lot of these criticisms that we sometimes hear from the East of the Western tradition, they exist within the Western tradition itself. So the Western tradition is not quite as monological as is sometimes presented. And Heidegger is definitely, you know, one of the big internal critics, and the direction of his critique, I think, is very kind of in harmony with what sometimes we hear from the East.
See, I think the distinctive thing about it seems to me that what Heidegger is saying, the distinctive thing about Western modernity, is that it's sort of fractal. It's splintered into lots of these different ground plans, and we lose our, we're alienated by the fact that we're constantly having to move between the different fractal parts that our world picture is split up into.
Yeah.
Whereas in the East, you know, in our imaginations at least, everything is still a sort of this kind of cosmic unity, perhaps, you know, embodied by that the sort of the cosmic wheel imageries that you see in Buddhism, and, you know, the yin and the yang and all of that kind of thing. And so it's not fractured, and they're not alienated, they're somehow still within the world rather than constantly looking at it as a picture, which I think is if I've understood you rightly, is what Heidegger was getting at. That'd be maybe the way I'd summarize it.
Yeah, it's hard to say what will they inhabit, right? It's hard enough for us to try and critique our own position. But maybe it's possible. On alienation, like, for sure, you know, the big thinker of alienation is Hegel, right? So that's where it comes from in the Western thought. And Heidegger picks up on it. So in the appendices, there is this very nice appendix 6. And maybe I'm reading aloud too much of this, but I find this text nice. So he,
I just really want to hear your German accent, Artem. I just would really.
No, I can't do a German accent. It's bad enough me speaking in English with a Russian accent to also then be.
We get an additional layer. Yeah.
Yeah. So he addresses this topic of values and kind of moving beyond the material to, you could say spiritual, but the idea of Heidegger is how even that kind of fails in the modern approach. And he first talks about the idea of system. And at the tail end of the discussion of system, at Appendix 6, he then comes up to this. So no less essential to the modern interpretation of beings is the representation of value. Where beings have become objects of representation, there, for the first time, in a certain sense, a loss of being occurs. This loss, vaguely and uncertainly enough perceived, is correspondingly quickly made up for through the fact that we attribute to the objects and the thus interpreted being a value. In general, we assess beings according to values and make them the goal of all action and activity. So make values the goal of all actions and activity. So this idea is that once we've kind of schematized our ground plans, the objects that are constituted in these ground plans, you know, the bodies of physics, the organisms of biology, they kind of they lose a very important aspect of their being, which is their normativity, right? So this needs to be reintroduced for the idea of value. And we talk about value and values just so much in a modern world. So I find this really amazing what he says next, that it's written out of 1938. And it just so nicely fits the current discussions, you know, with the wokeism and the all sorts of discussions of values. So here's what he says. Since this latter conceives itself as culture, values become cultural values, and these become the general expression of the highest goals of creation devoted to the self-establishment of man as subjectum. From here, it is only a short step to making values into objects themselves. Values become the objectification of needs as goals brought about by a representing self-establishment within the world as picture. Values appear to be the expression of the fact that in relation to them, man strives to promote precisely what is most valuable. In fact, however, it is precisely values that are the powerless and threadbare mask of the objectification of beings, an objectification that has become flat and devoid of background. No one dies for mere values, which I think is just perfect.
That is really good. I'm thinking of British values as
yeah.
British values.
Because really talk of values as a way of extricating ourselves kind of from the nonsense that we were led to through the modern world view, and we have to kind of reintroduce what is it valuable about the world in detachment from the object themselves. And then, yeah, of course, values themselves become objectified. But because it's not even clear what we're talking about, this is like chasing after ghosts. So I think that's the real problem. And the one that you kind of hinted at with the comparison of the Eastern and the Western world, and the Western world is being alienated, he kind of really picks up on that here, because the way to overcome alienation is this continuous talk of values, trying to establish, well, what is it that's valuable? What are our values? But of course, where are we to find these, right? There is really nothing that we can latch on to except for what's in the world. But what's in the world has been subjected to these has been reconstructed as projections of the ground plans. So we now need to add these values, but we don't really have anywhere to source them from. And so this alienation becomes in some sense non-overcomable, at least within the picture that we inhabit, the world is picture. So yeah.
Do you think this is related to the kind of universalist tendencies as well of sort of Western thought? Do you think this is where the kind of universalizing tendency is getting its impetus, in the sense that our values are not grounded in a particular ground plan? Instead, they're sort of plastered on the top, and that makes us want to say, well, they apply always and everywhere to everyone, because if they didn't, it would sort of invalidate them because of the nature of their origins. Is that right, do you think, or have I misunderstood something there?
I think that's one of the ways in which that can manifest. And of course, relativism would be the other side. And completely, it's like two sides of the same coin here. So on one hand, either you try to find these values, you can't find them in the world, so you try to find them somewhere else, but the idea is you try to find something as objective as objects themselves, and you try to find value as object and insist that here we found the value and everybody should recognize it as a value. Or on the other hand, you say, well, values are just a matter of opinion. And neither is a solution.
No. I think it was you that pointed out, Artem, and I never had it put quite so clearly, that relativism collapses under its own weight because the position of relativism becomes merely just a unverifiable opinion, which I always quite like. It's a good point.
All right. I have to go.
Well, thank you for that. That was remarkable, because when I first read this, I didn't get all of that. And what mostly stuck out was a kind of lament over the death of the gentleman scholar, which looking through my underlinings, is most of it. Yeah, it's now all about process and funding applications. But yeah, following that hour, I now read it back through and it's like, oh yeah, that's pretty obvious.
A bulk of the article is a description of science as research and constant activity, which I also just thought when I read the article, it's incredibly topical. It's incredible to think that written in 1938.
I did kind of feel like I understood that, and I was like, yes, this is very interesting and very, very acute. Yeah.
And then there are some Greek terms that they thought we would discuss, like when what Heidegger says about what mathematical means, and mathemata as the one that's whatever has been agreed before.
It can mean that in the sense that it's a sort of participle, but I don't know whether, I mean, he says it with so much sort of, you know, force and conviction that this is what they meant by it. It's kind of like, well...
I think that's fairly typical of Heidegger's use of Greek terms. I think proper classicists like to make fun of his forays into this.
From my perspective, I wouldn't make fun of him, but I would say that he's possibly a little bit too certain about what the Greeks meant by those particular words, is the only thing I would say. But no, Artem, thank you so much. I mean, we definitely need you as sort of a patient explainer taking us through that. So thank you. Why couldn't he just say it the way you say it, Artem? Why does he have to say, you know, all of this nonsense in his German accent? Why can't he just put it like you put it, and then I'd get it? You know?